Welcome to another episode of Foolproof Theology. My name is Chase Davis, and I am your host. It's a great day to be with you here again. We have a great guest today, Yuri Brito, good friend. We've had him on the show before, so returning guest, and we're going to talk about his book, War of the Priesthood. Yuri, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Hey, Chase, real pleasure, my man.
Hey, so this War of the Priesthood, it goes through Ephesians 6, the armor of God. This is a story that I grew up hearing about in church. Growing up in the Baptist church, they would have the flannel graph and they would put, you know, the different features on. It's a cool image. It's one I try to teach my kids a lot about, especially boys, you know, kind of connects with them. And so I'm curious, though, in your book, how do you maybe you challenge some common misconceptions about the armor of God in Ephesians 6? How do you kind of either complement or challenge common notions?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that do match that general sort of structure taught in the traditional Sunday school lesson. But the vast majority of it, I would just I'd happily sort of pile in a millions of pieces of paper and burn it in my backyard. I think what it has traditionally done is it has softened the image of the Apostle Paul, and it has transformed into this Jesus shepherd, white sand sort of hallmark figure, where instead of this armor being something that is threatening to principalities and powers or threatening to those who would despise the gospel, it actually becomes relatively mild in terms of its opposition. And the image that I think the Apostle Paul is establishing in Ephesians 6 is an image that he's borrowing from a much greater and a much more powerful source. And that's the image of the ordained priest that we find in Exodus 28. But again, Sunday school lessons weren't filled with life verses from Exodus 28. And I grant that, so which means that we're going to have to sort of rethink how the Apostle Paul viewed the structure of the Bible and how he very carefully and very strategically used the images of the Old Testament to shape the armor of God. So I think these are at least what I try to sketch out in the book is an overview of the armor of God that falls into the continuity of redemptive history, rather than thinking that the armor of God is merely Paul thinking on the spot or coming up with an image out of nothing.
Yeah, that makes sense. Whenever I preach this passage and studied it with other Christians, there's a great temptation today to almost make it a Gnostic reading where, you know, it's very immaterial and he's just using an illustration to get to spiritual truths. And that can be hard as a preacher because Paul is doing some of that, right? He is obviously communicating spiritual truths about faith and these kind of matters, but we have to be careful that we don't, dematerialize the text and make it applicable to people. What would convince you? I mean, this is a fairly common reading that you're going to see all the time, where Paul's just using a Roman soldier. Are you bringing that kind of redemptive historical continuity idea, and that's how you would choose to interpret that passage because of that? Or is there something in the text that pops out to you that would make you think he's referencing the priesthood in Exodus 28? How did you get to there?
Yeah, good question. I think part of what's happening is that Paul is confronting the Roman Empire as a whole, which is no easy task, of course, but I think he's confronting. He's telling the saints in Ephesus that there are two competing coverings. One is offered by the Roman Empire with all its authority and might and conquest and songs and rhythms. And the other is a covering that's not nearly as attractive, at least from a worldly standpoint. It's a covering from an alternative kingdom, an alternative city. And that city brings with it all of its biblical investments. And that means not only investments, but also vestments and paraments, and it brings all its rituals and colors. And so Paul is looking at the Old Testament priest and all that priestly world and seeing that image fitting very well into this armor that he's building. And the armor, of course, has spiritual realities to it, that Christians need to be reshaped, reformed. But overall, what Paul is doing is he is borrowing the language of the Old Testament, and he's saying priests have a protective role in the kingdom of God. Priests are called to protect the sacred and the holy. And he's drawing the image here that we take from not only the priesthood, but even farther back, I argue in the book, to the Garden of Eden when the first priest, Adam, allowed a false priest to come in, and Adam entered into dialogue with that priest. And I argued that Adam's fundamental role as a priest was to crush the devil. And in Paul's writings, what he's saying is, look, the same wicked schemes that the devil used in the garden, he's using now in Ephesians chapter 6, and he will use with your church. And so now you have to dress up for the occasion. And dressing up to the occasion means covering yourself from the head, from the helmet of salvation, all the way to the feet, the shoes that bring good news to the nations. And so it's a complete, totalistic, comprehensive vision. And Paul says you can't allow any of these pieces to be set aside for whatever reason, because if you do, one little piece is sufficient for the devil to infiltrate and take over the whole armor, and in a corporate sense, take over the whole church. So this is in many ways, a very communal text, because he's addressing the church as a whole.
So with this idea of priest and warfare, I think this is fairly foreign to the normal kind of evangelical, you know, reading. I've read James Jordan on these matters, and when we preached through Judges, and we saw Deborah, and I think it was Barak, right?
Yes.
And navigating that in our world is very important to speak clearly about the role of the priest and warfare and that kind of thing. How would you further articulate for kind of a, you know, someone like my family who goes to just a good church, but maybe not as familiar with this idea of priests being warriors? I think most people, when they hear priest, they think of someone very empathetic, compassionate, you know, almost like a counselor, rather than somebody with a sword in their hand. So can you draw that out a little bit more?
Part of the problem is that in some ways, the consensus on commentaries when talking about Ephesians chapter 6 is that you have this Roman soldier that's sort of standing there, represented the Roman Empire, and the Christian is to imitate that Roman soldier in the way he thinks about the world. Now, of course, that is largely tamed by what you mentioned earlier, is that, well, you're only to imitate this warrior in a spiritual way. Right, there are no tangible implications, right, to use Doug Wilson's famous language. You know, theology comes out of your fingertips. No, that's too far. You can't go there. And the way you tame that is by simply saying, look, you see the sword of the Spirit, that's just your private Bible reading. It's just your we used to say it as kids in the Baptist church. It's just your devotional time. And so the armor pieces become just a way of decorating your devotional life. When in reality, if the language does go back to the book of Exodus, to the Torah, the reality is that the people of God have always been, since the first deceiver went into the garden, from that moment on in Genesis 3 to the end of history, the people of God have always been in some war or another, because that's the premise of Genesis 3:15. The seed of the woman shall crush the head of the serpent. That's war language. And my argument is that theme that you find in what we call the Proto-Evangelion, the first gospel in Genesis 3:15, is repeated in a thousand ways throughout the scriptures. You mentioned the book of Judges. You have a lot of interesting themes there. But one of the themes you see in the book of Judges is six times you have people being crushed in the skull. Well, these are not random details, right? The Spirit doesn't waste his breath. This is the Bible echoing the theme of Genesis 3:15, the seed of the woman shall crush the head of the serpent. And you can take that theme all the way to the end of Malachi in this antithesis is being played out. And that's why the Gospel of Matthew, the Gospel of Mark, the Gospel of Luke begins by putting Jesus' ministry right at the point of baptism, and that baptism doesn't lead him to happy green pastures. That baptism leads him to the wilderness. To fight whom? To fight the devil. Why? Because the point of the gospel accounts is that Jesus comes as the second Adam to undo what the first Adam did. The first Adam was deceived. The second Adam is not deceived. So there's a replaying of themes. And the indication is that for the Christian is constantly at war against something. It could be principalities and powers. It could be the woke agenda of the left. He's always at war with a group or an ideology that would seek to minimize the image of the priest. So one way to test this case is to say, to test who is doing the right thing, who's pursuing the right trajectory and who isn't, is to ask them, is the Christian at war? And if he answers only spiritually, I can guarantee you there's a trajectory that's leading him or her or them as an institution away from biblical authority. And, you know, I can test that case 1,000 times and I'll probably get 999 accuracy rate.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. And it's an important concept for Christians to recover today in our time. Speaking of that, is, you know, as you walk through these various pieces of armor that Paul is expounding upon, relating them to how we should clothe ourselves comprehensively, and this applies to every Christian, would there be one piece of armor that, as you're kind of writing this book, that you're like, this is one that most Christians today need to pay particular attention to more than others? Did one piece of armor kind of stand out as you're writing this book?
The thing that I focus on, I probably give a bit more attention because I think it's misunderstood, and that's the helmet of salvation, which a lot of people view it as some kind of protective gear. But again, the whole armor is a protective gear, so I don't want to simply say every piece is meant to protect, because that's too obvious. But what I wanted to say about the armor is that the armor begins, there's an intentionality to it. There's a structure to it that what we see in the beginning, that the armor begins with truth, and then it continues, but it's building a case. And that case, if we see it covenantally, that case begins on top with initiation and then ends in the bottom with the feet, which is the commissioning. In the covenant renewal worship, Chase, you see that very principle. There's a call into worship, which begins with the baptism of the saint, which is the ordination of the Christian into priesthood. Whether you're Presbyterian or Baptist, it still works. And then that baptism is taken when the people at the end are commissioned to send forth and disciple the nations. So these two elements have to play. But you asked specifically if there's an armor piece that our people need to consider today. In light of our, he may be your friend, he's just an acquaintance of mine, but in light of Aaron Wren's new book, I think if it is true that the proposition, the negative world exists, and that we live in a negative world, the armor piece that would stand out to me would be the breastplate of righteousness, which I view as the element of discernment for the Christian. And I think in our day, to live in a negative world requires a level of discernment that didn't exist, certainly not in the positive nor in the neutral, but now it must exist, which means we have to be, as the historical books testify, we have to be sons of Issachar, not only once, but twice. We need degrees in the spirits, and then we need a degree in discerning the spirits. And the spirits, the principalities and powers, are certainly political figures at its highest level, but principalities and powers are also those who would seek to cause division within the church by teaching, maybe they're not teaching another gospel, but they're teaching a gospel that's twisted, a gospel that is not presented in its full force. And so I would say the breastplate of righteousness is something very significant for the Christian today, because the Christian, both at its pastoral level and its parishioner level, need an extra measure of discernment. And that's the one piece where I think Satan has infiltrated the most and has caused the most amount of confusion in the church today.
Yeah, and I can see that play out with a lot of people are looking for institutions. You know, I'll get messages or just talk to people like, well, who can I trust? You know, exactly. And I can be fairly, you know, not slanted, but just like I can easily poke holes. Whether that's a gift or a curse, it's just part of my nature. I can kind of like, yeah, you know, see kind of different arguments play out and their end. And so I'll get church members to meet with me. It's like, well, fine, Chase. Okay. We accept this may be correct, but then who can we trust? And so this is a helpful illustration to say, discernment is what a lot of people are looking for. Like, who can I read? Who should I, or not just can, but who should I be kind of like listening to in the car on podcasts? Who should I be, you know, associating with? Because right now in our day with kind of the individualized society, the fracturing, the great sorting, whatever you want to call it, a lot of people are asking this question. As the church moves forward, one key component is our worship together. And so I wanted to hear your thoughts on kind of this. You've got kind of the saints gathered together. They've strapped on their armor. We're worshiping together. We're singing music together. And while it may be frowned upon in some circles, I think it's a very compelling vision that, as we see in the Old Testament, song and the Psalms specifically, we're always integral to the people of God moving forward in mission, whether that's in conquest or anything else. And so how does this idea of music as warfare, some people will put it worship as warfare, what is that role in the church? What is the role of music in that in the church today?
Yeah, just I want to phrase what you just said. I want to repeat it, but I want to say it in an English Brazilian accent. Worship is warfare. And in case someone is dubious about how I feel about it, worship is warfare. And I think that concept needs to be stressed again and again from different angles, different framing perspectives on things. And the reason it's doubted at times is because people don't view the church as central in any way. They view it as merely an institution that is meant to get you to heaven. And that's very problematic, because then if the church is merely an institution to get you to heaven, there's nothing that would keep you from individualizing that data or individualizing that armor. And I think we probably saw a lot of this during COVID, where people viewed it precisely that way, Chase. The church is merely a spiritual entity to get me to heaven. Therefore, I can do this church business on my own, because I know the truth. I read the Bible in and of myself. However, if the church is a continuation, if the church in the 21st century is a continuation of the church that was established in the Garden of Eden with its first priest, Adam, then the motif of warfare has been very much entrenched in the way and embedded in the way the Bible functions from beginning to end, so that the people of God are not merely surviving or existing, but the people of God are fighting and bringing principalities and powers into submission, because the gates of hell shall not prevail against the church, which means it doesn't mean the church is merely in a defense. The church is in an offense. She's pushing the claims of Jesus farther and farther. And so when the people gathered, if you were to look at what's happening when the people gather in the Sunday morning, what you would see essentially is the unveiling of heaven, the opening up of the heavenly curtains, and you would get a glimpse of what happens on the throne room of God himself, who invites us to come boldly before the throne of grace. So heaven is a manifestation of the principle we see. Let me phrase this way. Worship is a response to the martyrs' cry in Revelation 6 when they cry, "How long, O Lord?" And when the martyrs cry, the church responds on Sunday morning saying, when the people say, "How long, O Lord?" the church replies by saying, "Now is the time when Jesus will act on your behalf. Now is the time of salvation. Today is the day of salvation, says the Lord. Today we declare and we enter into holy communion with the martyrs of old, and we join their corporate cry, 'Lord, bring justice on earth.'" And if that's the case, then what happens when the people gather is more than merely the conviviality of people waiting for heaven, but it is the community of people waiting to bring heaven to earth and to merge earth to heaven. It's the fulfillment of the prayer, "Thy kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven."
Yeah, I totally see that. And I think this is just a really compelling point, because like you said, I mean, the church is not merely, although it is a way, means of salvation. It is a way, I mean, that's the kind of tradition I was raised in, and the Baptist church was, it was kind of a, you can call it a reduction, yes, but it is an important, essential, crucial aspect that this is where you can't experience salvation out there. You're going to find it here in Jesus Christ. And yet there's much more going on than first meets the eye. There's much more than just the church is merely a spiritual entity. There are things going on, and we're doing warfare in a more comprehensive way. So talk to me about you know, with this idea of the priest, I think some people may be dismayed by it because they may view, well, my pastor's like my priest, you know, it's just a Protestant priest. And, you know, there's an important Protestant principle regarding the priesthood of all believers. And so why is it important not just for me to put on my armor as an individual Christian, kind of like you referenced devotional kind of material, but why is it important that all the people of God together function as a group, armored up as the priesthood of all believers?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think what Luther worked through as he fought the church of the day was this precise theological dogma there. But the way evangelicals have interpreted that is not very different than the way Rome has interpreted that. Evangelical Christians say, we don't have a pope. Why? Because we are our own popes. And that's not what Luther meant by the priesthood of all believers. Luther understood the biblical rationale that God has created a royal priesthood in 1 Peter chapter 2. We are a kingdom of priests unto God. And so to believe in the priesthood of all believers is to believe that we are priests unto one another in submission to the true priest. So priesthood is not synonymous with an isolated world, because after all, who would be frightened by a one-man army, right? And so Jesus Christ is, we might say, our one-man army, but even Jesus is not disconnected from the body. Jesus is the head and we are the body. And so that's the comprehensive picture we have to keep in mind, not the one that says we can fight on our own, Jesus, my Bible, and my relatively dark closet so I can read my Bible. That's not the image. The image is this body of believers and this brightness, this light, and this image of Christ's people warring together. And that's what the true priesthood is. It's a true priesthood composed of men and women baptized in the triune name. And when people are baptized in the Bible, one of the first things that happens is they're sent to the wilderness. And that's what the people of God are doing. They're reclaiming the wilderness and making it into a place of worship for the Most High God.
Amen. That's a wonderful illustration to end on there, Yuri. I want to make sure we point people to where they can pick up your book, which is, if you're a listener, very easy to read. You know, it's not one of those thick books. It was funny, Yuri, young man at our church, he wanted a copy of Frame Systematic. Because he knows I enjoy Frame. And so we bought him one just to bless him. And I brought it to church, or our assistant brought it to church, and I delivered it to him. And it's just huge, you know, huge. And so I felt bad for the guy, but he's very excited. But if you pick up Yuri's book, it's not going to be that way. It's going to be very easy to read, very helpful, and very applicable. So where can people pick up a copy of The War of the Priesthood?
Yeah, thank you, Chase. And I wrote the book for it to be digestible and used for men's studies, Bible studies, something. I wrote it for the church. They can go to Noggin Nose Press, which is N-O-G-G-I-N-N-O-S-E. Noggin Nose Press, a lovely little publishing company in Arkansas, doing really good graphic work. I think you'll like the typeset, the format, and that's the best place to get a copy of the book. The book was just released a few days ago, so you can get it fresh off the press.
Excellent. All right, I'll put a link to that in the show notes for the listeners. Yuri, thanks so much for spending some time with me today.
Hey, my absolute pleasure, brother.